You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening. We are joined by a very special guest co-host, Jill Bernstein of South Fork Law and Elected Connections, two wonderful shows that are also on KMRE. Welcome, Jill.
Oh, hi, Stephanie, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Absolutely, and we are too. Jill is also the co-chair of the Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force. We're going to get into that and how later on. But let's start with a quick hit. We've been talking about the county and water wells for several weeks now. Tim, where are we on that now?
Well, what happened this week, or last week, I guess it was, was that the House Ag Committee were reluctant to move forward on the Senate bill, the legislative fix for exempt wells. And there's an old saying in legislative action that when the outcome is uncertain, you don't bring a bill forward. And I think what happened there was that there was a really good chance that they weren't going to get that ag committee to move the action forward. And if they did not move it forward, it would die. And so rather than see it die this session, they pulled it out with the idea that maybe they could come back with something at some future point this session on the issue of residential wells.
I heard in expressing his disappointment that Senator Erickson said, it's not dead yet. But, I mean, people always say that at the end of a session, and it is pretty dead.
Yeah, I don't know. It very well could be dead because I'm not sure how many more iterations the legislature has to bring things forward in reconciliation. I think it may be in trouble. But what I wrote about this week was what happened in the House was a whole bunch of very late amendments were proposed for this bill, and I just think that that washed out the enthusiasm for that particular committee to move it forward. So when I do watch these things, but when I watched the action, they were supposed to bring it forward and give a recommendation to move it onto the full floor of the House for a vote. It didn't even come up for a vote. They just simply withdrew it. And I think that the reason they withdrew it was my sense is that the Republicans on that committee overstepped and they put forward too much too soon for large scale support of that bill. And I wrote about it. You know, part of the issue there was I feel like what they are trying to do with this legislative fix is fundamentally opposed to the very idea of the Growth Management Act. And what I mean by that is the Growth Management Act is a top-down kind of program that says the counties are ultimately in control and they have last authority on all land use decisions. There's a board that comes in and coaxes them to go the right way, but when a county puts its foot down, it's assumed to be correct in its land use decisions unless it can be proven that it is clearly erroneous. And an analog of that might be that, you know, in criminal law, someone is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Well, on the Growth Management Act, a county is presumed to be correct in what it decides to do unless you can prove that it is clearly wrong, which
is a
very high bar.
And that's an excellent metaphor, and that's what happened. I mean, to give us a recap,
yes.
That's what happened in Whatcom.
Yeah, that is what happened. The county didn't even have a leg to stand on. I mean, in fact, they didn't even argue that they had a leg to stand on and in front of the Supreme Court in terms of their authority to try to coordinate growth with growth resources. So that's really that's the essence of the Hearst decision. They did not coordinate where they planned growth with where resources are available. So the legislative fix basically says, you don't have to do that. And in fact, some of the amendments that came in late said that counties and cities, nobody locally has any responsibility for this. Well, that's a pretty violent contradiction of growth management.
Because it's trying to gut it.
Well, it doesn't gut it, but what it, if you have ultimate authority to do something, you also have ultimate responsibility as well. I mean, when you're given a license to drive, you are given the freedom of the road, but you that does not absolve you of your responsibility to drive in a correct and lawful, proper manner.
Yeah, but you're really talking about reason and logic. And, you know, is that really what prevailed was reason and logic?
No.
Well, so.
No, not at all.
Yes.
Well, I think what's at work here is there's a desire on behalf of the county, almost a panic, not to be responsible for any of the impacts of the land use decisions that are just being routinely made.
Well, and this whole issue is so toxic. I think that, like you were saying, some folks in the House, I think they overplayed their hand thinking that the other members of the committee would have to support whatever they did because they saw this as a must-pass situation. And I'm happy that people are standing up to that. I think that the situation we're in now, post-Hearst, is not a good one, and it would be nice to have a fix from the legislature. It would be nice to have an actual fix and not just let's throw out the rules and go from there.
Well, what do you mean it's not good? I don't know what you mean by that. Isn't good?
Well,
the court was very clear.
The court was clear, but the situation now is difficult. It would be nice if there were some measure from the legislature to aid in
helping counties to follow the rules?
Exactly, and helping homeowners to determine water usage. And it would be nice to see overall, in the long term, rethinking of the way we manage water in this state.
Right, but at the center of this supposed legislative fix is this idea that well drillers will be the final determinant of whether there is adequate water supply. I mean, in other words, the person that's going to get $30,000 if they say yes and going to get zero if they say no is going to be the person that is considered the authority on that. And I'd like to step back and just say, I'm not saying that these people are crooked, but if something is on the threshold, if a determination of adequate supply is on the threshold, yes, no, where does the public confidence come from? Because
right.
The public confidence is contained within this idea that somebody's going to profit if they say yes, and right. They're not going to profit if they say no.
Well, and you don't have to imply that somebody's crooked to look at where their interests lie and maybe their vision. Their vision is, I need to make a living. I need to drill this well. And in order to do that, I need to look at where the water is right now. They don't need to look
right.
at 10, 15,
right.
20 years down the road. That's not necessary. Not saying that
right.
they should or shouldn't, but isn't that what the county is for?
It calls into question the whole idea of impartiality, because even if you're not going to make a profit as a well driller, you still are on the side of the homeowner. That's what you do. You help homeowners drill a well on their property. You help them. And even if you're not going to be financially, you're still in this realm of really being on the side and a cheerleader for a particular outcome. And it's I don't know why the county would abdicate its responsibility to do appropriate and lawful planning and ferry that all over, deed that all over to private well drilling companies and think that is an appropriate fix for the problems that face Whatcom County.
Well, unless Dave's right that, the bottom line is the desire to avoid responsibility because you don't like any unpleasantness. The word you used was toxic. I don't know if that's a step too far or not, but, with privilege, like getting to set the rules, comes responsibility. And you got to, what happened to the buck stops here? I mean, that's what I'm looking at, both locally and nationally. Who's going to take responsibility and live with the outcomes? You make the best decisions you can and live with the outcomes.
So what happens now? So there's people who are wanting to drill, who have bought land, believing that they could, And now it's just everything's in stasis? Until
well, I've got, you know, I haven't documented this and I haven't quantified it, but my strong hunch based upon a lot of stuff that I've heard is anybody that had a trapped asset is being taken care of piecemeal, case by case, by county planning and the permitting department, and they're being allowed to move forward. Whether or not somebody gets to put forward an absolute new building site from this moment because there's a moratorium on this. I mean, thank God the county council decided not to dig the hole deeper by continuing to allow permits all of this uncertainty is in the air. But if you were caught in the pipeline, your project is moving forward.
So what? And I know we have lots of other things to get to, but I can't help but think again, the people who put forward this bill said that they were very disappointed. They said it over and over again. What, if anything, might be the political implications of this bill failing down the road?
Well,
I'm looking at Dave.
You're looking at Dave, but I want to answer that.
Okay.
Because we have a limited amount of time. But I want to answer it because really the proposal off another side was to create water banks and to create a financing and funding mechanism through the state to actually deal with the problem really, truly, instead of just papering it over by saying it's a problem that we know exists is not a problem. I think if it fails, they should go back to the solutions that are actually working in on the Olympic Peninsula, Yakima County, in central Washington, where they're actually setting up water banks, and it's working. It's working very well. And I would like to see a real solution, not just a fake solution.
But then you have to get serious about quantification. Then you have to, like, devote your resources to looking at what do we really have and asking the question and then answering it honestly. You just can't pretend that there's enough water for everybody and for everything that they want to do.
Right. Well, and that's exactly it. And there's this thing in public policy where it seems like the people making the decisions think that every problem can be reduced to a couple of sentences. And this is really a fundamentally difficult problem, quantifying our water use and setting priorities. And until we're ready to do something like that, we're going to keep running into trouble.
Some of the priorities are there.
Unfortunately, we do have to move on, and I know we're going to be talking about this issue much more coming up. But let's take a look as we're getting towards the last few weeks of the legislative session. We hope it's supposed to end April 23rd. We'll see. But Dave, why don't you tell us what else we're looking at?
Well, we're kind of in the bargaining phase right now. Everybody's kind of deep in budget talk, and I really want to give a plug to anyone who's really interested to check out fiscal.wa.gov. It's got all of the budget proposals. It's got interactive maps so you can see where these different proposals have, you know, funding suggestions and things. You can find out whose proposal has $100 and some grand in it to make the Ferndale Village ADA compliant and fun facts like that. The big things that have happened recently are the state Republican Party is trying to force a showdown on Sound Transit 3 funding. That was a proposal that was passed by voters in the Sound Transit area, which is Pierce, King, and Snohomish County. Did not pass Pierce County, but it passed enough in the other counties to go through that extended the Sound Transit taxing authority and was specifically to fund new improvements like another 60-some miles of light rail, 30-some stations, and enhanced commuter bus service to outlying areas. And some folks in the legislature want to relitigate that and want to cut back some of that because it's become a little more politically problematic now, because people have started to get their car tabs bills and are seeing just what that's costing. So
what the alternatives are.
Yeah, they're trying to make some points on that. On the other side, there's a lot going on with the funding for the Puget Sound Partnership and some other especially cleanup and restoration around Puget Sound.
And that's what funding. The partnership specifically focuses on.
Yeah, because it's pretty obvious now that a lot of the federal money that people thought was coming isn't going to be there. The EPA cut in the Trump administration's budget proposal is greater than 30%. And that's going to be a lot of people at the Bellevue office if that is enacted. So there's jockeying on both sides. I do want to give a shout out to the resolution to fund a special commemoration of the women's suffrage amendment in 2020. The centennial of that is proceeding and looks like it's headed for the governor's desk last I saw. And that's what I've been paying attention to.
Holy cow, that's a lot. And we actually have a couple more issues that deal with the state legislature, and we are going to get to them right after this.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
The League of Women Voters is hosting a program at Whatcom Community College Heiner Theater focusing on jail diversion and positive criminal justice solutions. The program is open to the public and begins at 9 a.m. and runs till noon on Saturday, April 15th.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now. Tonight, your hosts, Tim Johnson and Dave Lingham, joined by Jill Bernstein, who is here on behalf of talking about the Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force. We'll be getting to that and some other issues soon, but let's just tidy up the last few things about the session as it stands today. Something that we have not talked about, and it started in the House, is in the Senate now, is a Work First Poverty Reduction Oversight Task Force. Now, the goal of this, at least originally, and it still has pieces of it, is, as stated, to target and reduce intergenerational poverty. What that means is poverty that goes from generation to generation, for the child, from the parent, as opposed to something like situational poverty, which is from losing your job or medical circumstances. So there's been an identification that intergenerational poverty in our state is tremendous and has a tremendously big, has a huge impact. And I think the original goal was to put this task force together with both legislators and stakeholders, such as state agencies, to look at long-term reduction of poverty and intergenerational poverty in our state, and what kinds of things can we do, especially as our budget diminishes, the state budget diminishes, as we get less and less federal help. How are we going to approach this situation? What's interesting is in the House, as is often the case, a lot of amendments came up, and so some of the things that have happened is that in terms of the amendments, there's been stricter evaluation suggestions for people who are using workforce. And a lot of so it started off as like, we're going to make recommendations in the next 10 years about how we can change things. And now it's, and we're going to be really careful that every individual who uses workforce has a plan, and they better stick to that plan to get a job. And it sort of changed the tone a little bit, even though the long-term solutions are in there. A couple of things that came up, for instance, there was a previous exemption in terms of the individual plan that you had to comply with in order to get help. There was an exemption for individuals with a child under the age of two, gone. And as Senator Kevin Ranker noted last night on social media, they also amended to remove ethnicity and gender as categories of disparities. That was brought to us by former Democrat, now Republican, Senator Mark Malosha.
Yeah, it's I think it's tragic, and I think it really shows that some of our values are misplaced when it's more worth it to pay people to hold the hoops for to make people jump through than it is to just help people who need help. It's very disappointing.
Yeah, and I guess what I would jump in, I think we're going to get into this in the second part of our show, but this is the idea of dealing with people, of dealing equitably with people of lower income is absolutely essential to so many things and can actually save money in the long run because you actually are preventing people from falling through the cracks, which is very costly. I hope we get into some of that, but it's very encouraging that the legislature wants to take up the notion of economic and income justice, because I think it's going to solve a lot of problems for the state. I hope they're passionate about it.
Absolutely. And we will be watching that. It's in the Senate right now. If you want to make a phone call about it, that would be a great idea. But the other thing that just happened in the past couple of days in response to our president who signed a bill that said that basically the internet companies could use your information, share your information, sell your information, didn't need your permission anymore. And thankfully, we had some good people in Washington State, including our Senator Kevin Ranker, who stood up and said, no, we don't like that. Dave, do you want to talk more about that and why it's important?
Yeah, and I'm going to give a little bit of background, and I'm going to, because we're low on time, I'm going to meander a little less than usual. So last year, in response to two big events, which were Verizon was fined for sending a unique header along with everybody's traffic so that you could follow someone wherever they went online if they were a Verizon customer, and AT&T charging an extra $30 to $60 a month if you did not want them to sell your browsing information. The FCC stepped up and passed a new rule that made it so that internet service providers could not sell your information to advertising companies and to data brokers, and that if they suffered a breach and your information was lost, they would have to report that. And one of the, you know, first thing that's happened of this new year and new era is that that regulation has been overturned in such a way that the FCC can never reinstate it. It would have to be done through Congress to be redone. So there's been a lot of reactions around the country to that, and Kevin Ranker's proposal is a step in the right direction. It would require that if a internet service provider wants to sell your information, they have to get your express written permission first, and makes it so that that becomes a basic consumer protection so that they can't say, oh, well, this is necessary for our business.
But what can he do beyond Washington? The state of Washington. I mean, how can Kevin Ranker possibly and his bill possibly affect the actions that have happened on the national stage?
There is nothing that can be done at the Washington level to really have a tremendous impact because a lot of these companies are not based in Washington, do not do business in Washington, and many of them aren't even in the United States.
So what's the bill about?
The bill is about specifically the ISP that has a franchise agreement with a Washington jurisdiction. Like here in Bellingham, we have Comcast until I think that comes up in 2021. They have tacked on to their regulations that they can't sell that without express written permission for their ability to do business in Washington.
And local service providers. And I just want to jump in and I want to say that what I find exciting about this particular thing is it's not just Kevin Ranker. Kevin Ranker reached out across the aisle,
right,
and he got Republican support. And the Republicans are on board with this. What's interesting is there's something that's gone haywire in Congress where they have forgotten, I think the Republican Congress has forgotten its fundamental values of privacy and that people should not be surveilled without their, I mean, you know, liberty, right? And essential privacy, issues of privacy. And for we in Washington State, that sounds kooky. Even if you're a Republican, it sounds kooky. And so Kevin reached across the aisle, and he got some Republican support. And I think that this bill is going to pass. And what it's going to do is it's going to do two things. It will prevent local ISPs, local service providers, from basically disseminating your information without your permission to do so. But it also is part of this thing that we've talked about a lot on the show, which is the states' rights issue, where there's the what I will guess I will start calling the Western Wall of Washington, Oregon, California, basically resisting that federal directive, which is misplaced.
And I think that goes back to Jill's question to Dave about, well, what good does it do in Washington? You're absolutely right. Kevin Ranker does not have the jurisdiction to change the world or the United States, but that so far,
yes,
that's another show. But
or
the
AT&T.
Resistance, but the resistance itself is making an impact. The same resistance of our beloved Fergie, our attorney general, and the same resistance of our governor as states see other states doing it. Yes, it's not the same. It's not what I want. I don't want this happening at all. But I think it's hugely important that states stand up and
I
say
do
no.
too. I think what's going on between the states and the federal government at this point is it's kind of an emperor's clothes thing where the Western states and more states are starting to say, wait a minute, what's going on at the federal level? Their fashion seems off to me somehow. What they're wandering around and parading around in seems off, and we're going to resist it. And I think that is I've called it a dance on the show before. I think it's a terrific dance between state power, federal power, and hopefully down the road you reach this consensus where you create harmony.
Absolutely.
Oh, I am usually the optimistic one.
Well, I mean, you have to have both sides, right? But I do want to jump really fast. We're all jumping. But when you talked about the bipartisan support, some of that bipartisan support includes State Senator Joe Fine,
absolutely,
who is leading majority senator. And so it's
correct,
not just the sort of the middle of the road people that you kind of expect. Like, this is a huge thing, and that's another way that hopefully we can model for the rest of the country. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, this bill could have been a lot better for people who care about their privacy. It could have prevented companies from charging more for not being able to sell your data. It could have just barred it outright. And it could have put in some, you know, differentiation between mobile providers and local, because the mobile space is a lot more complicated. There's a lot more personal data there, and they need a lot more kind of specific fine-tuning. But on the other hand, so far this thing has like 35 co-sponsors in a 49-member body.
And it just happened this week. This is not a bill that, right. And so the only other question, we're running out of time, but the only other question I have is, because this is not a necessarily budget-related bill, the fact that it was introduced late, does that mean its chances are not as good?
They do have some latitude to bend their own rules. It's possible that this could be made into law this year. I'd still say it's an outside chance, but with the support that it's got, it'll probably get out of the Senate.
Absolutely. And we have a whole lot more in the second half of the show. We're going to get into some issues about the Whatcom Jail, who's in it, who should be in it, and that's coming up right after this.
Women's Spirit Coalition, eliminating violence against Native women and promoting the well-being of Native families and communities. We envision a nation where Native women live safely, and where Women's Spirit Coalition is the leader in ending violence against Native women. You can find us on Facebook at Women's Spirit Coalition or online at womensspirit.net.
You are tuned to Cascadia News now on KMRE 102.3 Bellingham, your community, your voice, your station. I'm Stephanie Contouris. I'm joined by co-host Jill Bernstein tonight, Tim Johnson, and Dave Willingham. And there was an excellent interview between Tim and Jill in this week's Cascadia Weekly. And Jill is the co-chair of the Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force. Let's just start off by unpacking that. What exactly is an Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force?
Well, we were created by the county council to look at ways in which we could reduce or prevent incarceration in Whatcom County. That's what's happening locally. It's really part of a national conversation that's going on about ways in which we can look to use our jails and prisons differently and ways in which we can perhaps treat mental illness and problems of substance abuse outside of jails and to hopefully use criminal justice specifically for crime as opposed to illness. And so locally, it's 24 people. There's people whose background is criminal justice, others whose background is behavioral health. Some are elected officials and some are just concerned citizens. We also have some members who are the heads of local nonprofits that interact with behavioral health and or the criminal justice system. So it's a big group of people busy talking and working on the subject.
You anticipated my question exactly, which was I wanted you to unpack that. I thank you for the interview that you did with me this week. I think this is an issue, this is a group that is flying below the radar. I don't think there's a lot of people in Whatcom County that know that this group has been meeting. It's such a large group. It's a complicated, complex group. And you jumped my question, which was, can you unpack this this group and what are their specific goals that they're trying to achieve?
Well, I really think it is that simple to reduce and prevent incarceration. But in order to do that work, we've broken into three subcommittees to try to make the work more manageable. So the first priority that was given to us by the county council was to enhance and improve our local triage facility. And so we've got one committee that's working very hard on a new, enhanced, and improved triage facility. We've got one subcommittee that's working very hard on behavioral health answers to these questions, and the other that's looking at law and justice. And we're looking at systems that are in place to look at what are we doing that perhaps we can do better, and what haven't we tried yet that perhaps could provide some positive solutions for the community.
And when you say triage, what does that mean? Because in my mind, it's like MASH or something, but it's something different.
I think about MASH too. But we have a facility that's currently located out on Division Street that is got two wings. One has to do with folks who are in mental health crisis, and the other has to do with people who are in crisis dealing with substance abuse issues. And these folks don't need to be in jail, and they don't need to be hospitalized. It's a short-term treatment facility that hopefully has the ability to stabilize the individual who's suffering from one of these problems, and then to hopefully have a good, solid continuum of care available in the community to hand them off to for long-term treatment to deal with whatever the issue was. So we've got a facility. It's almost always full. It's so often full that law enforcement stops looking at it as being a resource and just looks at jail and hospital as resource. But we're hoping to expand it to be as big as our funding sources allow and to have it be a vibrant and robust alternative for our community.
So this facility is separate from the jail, is connected to the jail?
Actually, it is not. It shares a site with jail alternatives out on Division Street, but it is not a jail facility. It is a voluntary treatment alternative to jail. It's a voluntary treatment alternative to the hospital. It's short-term crisis management. 3 to 5 days is the normal stay for individuals who find themselves there.
So I wanted to look at just the aspect of people who are in our jails right now who are substance users, who have mental health issues. How does that fit into the bigger picture of our state and our state funding? And how did it get to be so people who aren't necessarily criminals are winding up in our jails?
I don't think that's true, first of all. I think that the people who are in our jail, for the most part, have committed a crime. How many of them also suffer from mental health problems and or substance abuse problems? The answer is almost all of them. In fact, I was a public defender at the beginning of my career, and I remember a particular moment where I asked the supervisor, could I please have one person on my caseload who does not have a major mental health problem and has average intelligence in all of their body parts? And he said, no, I couldn't have one. There weren't enough to go around.
So let me correct my question and say people who might be better served in a treatment facility as opposed to a jail.
Why are they in the jail? Well, again, I think you have to start with the fact that people who are in the jail are alleged to have committed a crime or have been convicted of a crime. So they're in jail because they've committed a crime. Now, can we do better? It's very expensive to incarcerate someone right now. I forget, it was $89 a day. I think now it's $98 a day to hold somebody in the jail. So that's probably the most expensive response to criminal behavior is incarceration. So we could, we could hold people in jail, in cages, incarcerate people, or we could take some of those resources and apply them outside of a jail and hopefully prevent recidivism. We could make people in communities healthier. So people are in jail because we've decided as a society that's how we're going to spend our money. Luckily, locally, we're earnestly rethinking that question, and we're hopefully going to come up with some other answers.
Well, Jill, one question I have for you is that one third of the people in the jail are in there essentially because they cannot afford bail to get out of there. And so these are people that, and you talked about people, they have committed crimes, but
no,
these people
are
alleged to have committed.
Well,
exactly.
And that exactly plays into your point about the bail.
And so maybe you can talk about some of the recommendations of the task force for to handle these people pre-trial and to see if we can reduce the number of people in jail simply by handling them in a different way.
Well, thank you. We look at that as being one of the real opportunities to reduce incarceration in our community. On any given day, the snapshot that we're looking at tells us that a third of the people who are in custody in the Whatcom County Jail are there pretrial. And that means they haven't been convicted of a crime. They've been accused of a crime. And in the state of Washington, our court rules tell us that everyone who's been accused of a crime and not convicted is entitled to bail. In fact, the presumption is that no bail will be set. The presumption is that if you're accused, you will not be held in custody waiting your trial date. You'll be out. There's only two reasons to set bail for an individual, and one is to make sure they come back for their trial date. And who doesn't come back? People whose lives are so chaotic and they're irresponsible and they don't show up, or people who have very limited connections with our community. Bail can lawfully be set for them. The other group of individuals that the court rules tell us bail can be set for is for folks whose behavior is dangerous, and we're concerned that they're going to continue to commit offenses if they're released from custody pending their trial date. But bail doesn't really tell us or do much to make sure the people come back or to make sure that they behave. Because if we look at the situation where you and I are both equally irresponsible, but you've got money and I don't, you're out and I'm in. So there are other things that we can do.
And you shouldn't be considered a better risk or better flight risk based on your class. And it makes me think about Dave and I have studied some stuff about similar situations in California where people can be bankrupted, innocent or guilty, by just the prison and how it becomes.
Well, that's a whole nother set of questions. But to correct what I was saying, the only individuals who aren't entitled to bail in the state of Washington are people who are charged with capital murder. Mm-hmm. So we look at a third of the people in custody in the Whatcom County Jail are there pre-trial, meaning they're presumed to be innocent and they don't have enough money to post for bail. So we can look at alternatives to cash bail. We can look at alternatives to bail and bail bonds, and that includes some things like pretrial supervision. And this is being used in many of the federal courts around the country. It's being used in state courts and in county courts around the country. Also, in Washington, we don't have a probation department for Superior Court. And so we're looking at what sort of, what would a pretrial supervision unit look like to make sure that people return for their court dates and behave themselves while they're waiting to come back for court. The success that pretrial supervision units have had around the country is actually quite remarkable. We can look at it in small scale and big scale and know that it works. And that's something that I hope that we're going to dive right into and create in Whatcom County.
So you mentioned that you've had some trouble with the police seeing your center as a resource because of its capacity issues. What kind of interaction or overlap do you have with law enforcement and corrections in Whatcom County?
In the task force? Mm-hmm. Well, they're well represented in the task force. Not only is the sheriff at the table, but also so are the paramedics and other representatives of law enforcement. The representative from the small cities is the deputy chief for the city of Linden, and so they're at the table as well.
So you were established by the county a couple of years ago?
About a year and a half ago.
A year and a half ago. And where are you now? You're going to be making recommendations?
We have been right along.
Oh,
and
good.
Those recommendations are being well received, I think, by the county council. Some of them actually don't need the county council. Some of these are just opportunities for departments within the county to look at themselves and what they're doing and to maybe look at things a little bit differently as a result of the input from the other folks at the table. An example of that is drug court. It was brought to our attention that one of the things that was perhaps limiting participation in drug court was the slow turnaround of an application to participate in the prosecutor's office. As a result, the prosecutor's office has made an earnest effort to move those petitions along more quickly, in the hopes of making sure that good candidates get into the program and aren't discouraged by delays. So some responses are happening just by way of the conversation of the group. Some of the recommendations are going to the whole of the county council, and they've been responding favorably. An example of that is that the sheriff felt that electronic home monitoring and all of our current jail alternatives programs had to be self-supporting, and he set his fees accordingly. And that was in response to a mandate from a previous administration. At his request, we've gone to the county council and asked them to review that. And in fact, they lifted the mandate for these jail alternative programs to be self-supporting. Therefore, the fees could be reduced or be completely subsidized as the sheriff felt appropriate for indigent offenders, allowing more people to be eligible. So we're seeing these recommendations being reviewed by both in-house and by the county council, and positive changes are happening even as we speak. See, I told you I was the optimistic one.
Yeah, you are very optimistic. You know, Jill, a few years back, the county council approved a mental health care sales tax. It was available to counties. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk about how that funding. I think there's a lot of people that are listening that are thinking, oh, my God, how is this going to impact my mm-hmm. wallet? But there actually is money. There are funds, and there are cost savings, too, and maybe you can talk about that.
Tremendous cost savings. As I was saying, the most expensive response to crime is incarceration. everything else you do is less expensive. For instance, the Yakima experience with a pretrial supervision unit is that in Yakima, it was costing them $89 a day to hold somebody in custody, and I believe $9 a day to have somebody being supervised by a pretrial supervision unit. So if you correctly analyze the offenders who come before you, the accused who come before you, figure out who can be properly supervised in the community, the cost savings to your community is enormous. And this leads me to my, I think, overarching point. When we talk about this being a conversation that's going on around the country, it's a conversation that actually unites left and right. I don't care whether you care about money or you care about the humanity of the individuals who are being held in cages.
Or safety of your community.
Or the safety of your community. It's all the same conversation. It's about saving money and saving people. We all can do it together. And this is not a subject that is separating left and right today. This is a conversation that's actually uniting us. And communities should be understanding that they're going to be well served financially by adopting these recommendations.
Absolutely. You're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contreras with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham. Our special guest co-host tonight is Jill Bernstein. And we are going to be continuing to talk more about jails and Whatcom County jail issues right after this.
Do you like ghost stories? Stories about ghouls, goblins, and things that go bump in the night?
Welcome to the world of Bellingham Terror, an original horror series set right here in 1935 Bellingham. Tune in at 7 o'clock on Tuesdays
or 1 o'clock on Saturdays
to 102.3 FM Bellingham Terror, Tales of Suspense and Mystery.
Brought to you by Megas Insurance.
On Saturday, March 18th, the League of Women Voters is sponsoring a program at the Bellingham Public Library from 10 to noon on the topic of changing our energy landscape and creating jobs, with keynote speaker Dr. Joel Swisher, director of the Institute for Energy Studies at Western Washington University. The League of Women Voters is hosting a program at Whatcom Community College Heiner Theater focusing on jail diversion and positive criminal justice solutions. The program is open to the public and begins at 9 a.m. and runs till noon on Saturday, April 15th.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color, y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de.
And you're listening to Cascadia News Now. We've been talking about the jail and the Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force. I do want to talk a little bit about some of the other questions that in your interview you didn't quite get to. But, Jill, you had said in the Cascadia Weekly, the other two issues are how to pay for a jail and where does the jail go. And I think that those are still, it's not something the task force works on, but I think it's a part of the bigger picture. And I think where we last left off, we weren't sure if we were going to see another sales tax initiative, but I think there's been some movement on that, Tim.
Well, I'm not sure when or when, where, how the executive is going to bring this forward. The deputy administrator, Tyler Schroeder, had said that he had confidence that it was going to be placed on the November ballot. My own sense is I'm not sure that the county council is going to be comfortable with that timeline, because I think that they are really anxious to get a report from the work of the task force, which I believe in some ways, and Jill probably disagrees with me, but I think it informs the idea of how big the jail is going to be and how much it costs and what the ballot ask is going to be.
Well, you're both right. And you're both wrong. So
thanks for coming in and letting us know.
Well, so the The task force that I'm working on is not looking at the question of size, funding, or location. We're not. Funding is a question that is being addressed by a separate working group, completely separate. I think they call themselves the Jail Stakeholders Working Group, and they, at the table there, there's a citizen representative, there's a liaison from our task force, but the key people at the table are people in law enforcement, the mayor of the city of Bellingham, county council and city council people, and what they're looking at is what Tim was talking about, is what should a ballot initiative look like, and they are moving forward apace with the hopes of putting it on the ballot at the earliest possible opportunity and moving forward as quickly as they can. When I talk with people in the community, they want to know about size and location. And you're right, these questions are do intersect, or they should, and they will help inform each other, but that's not a question that the task force that I'm working on is answering, and that's not a question that the jail stakeholders working group is answering. When I've asked the executive, he said that question properly belongs with the county council. If I were on the county council, I would be looking at all of this information. I would be looking at the question of what if the task force is really successful? What if they are able to dramatically reduce the population in the Whatcom County Jail? What if we built in Bellingham rather than Ferndale? What if? And but that's the county council set of questions. I think that Jill, the citizen, when she's out there talking with other citizens, this is the question people have, is right. Where will it be and how big is it going to be, and which ultimately informs how much is it going to cost, right?
You said if you were on county council, I could see that potentiality. No, you have an announcement that you want to break on Cascadia News Now. Okay.
I will absolutely, positively never find myself in that position.
Oh, one can dream. Anyway, one of the questions that I have is that there was a report, I think, last year about the county courthouse also costing a whole lot of money for repairs. So anybody want to jump in to even try to speculate how the county and the county council might try to wrestle with those two issues?
I'll jump in on that a little bit. I don't know that we should spend much time on that, but it's all kind of part of a package where apparently when the county courthouse was remodeled a few years ago and a jail was attached onto it, there for some reason, I mean, and I think you could say that it was intensely negligent, but it's passed beyond actionable. It's like the statute of limitations or whatever has ran out on the county wanting to get its money back for some of the work that was done on the. So there are deficiencies in structure in both the county courthouse and the jail facility, although a report came out in the fall of last year that said that the jail is actually in pretty good structural shape and could be rehabilitated. It didn't say that should happen. It just simply laid out there that it could happen, that the current structure is sound and could possibly be remediated. That's something the voters will have to think about.
As is always the case. Well, we will continue to look at this issue as it is an ongoing one for Whatcom County, and I'm sure it will come up many more times on our show. But for now, let's take our last few minutes. I wanted to take a quick moment to mention on the state level that one of our newest congresspeople in Washington State, Representative Pramila Jayapal, joined Bernie Sanders and proposed a tuition bill. Again, and this is on the federal level, it's called the College for All Act, and it's great to see Representative Pramila Jayapal stepping forward on this. Once again, the bill would provide 4-year public college free for families that earn under $125,000 a year. It would make community college free for all. And one of the things that I liked about – I don't have a lot of hope for this bill, but one of the things that I liked about it was that it includes in the bill of preventing the federal government from profiting from student loans.
But you know, that's been one of the pie in the sky things for a while, and it's nice to see that people are still talking about it. I was just reading a study the other day that was talking about how if your family income is $65,000 a year and you put aside 10% of your net income for 10 years, you could send your kid to perhaps 2%
wow.
of colleges in the country. And this is a ongoing and folding crisis that has just been building. And we've seen law schools become astronomically expensive. We've seen med schools become astronomically expensive. In the last 15 years, it has gotten insane, such that the value proposition of them has gotten pretty bad at a time when, you know, it would be nice to have educated professional people.
And I guess I look at it from a more general standpoint. A smarter, better educated, more knowledgeable society is just, it's a goal that the country, I mean, why would you not pursue that as a goal nationally, that your citizens would be better educated, better skilled, more capable of advancing the future? I mean, why would you stop that from happening?
Absolutely. And we're in a community, obviously, on top of it, that you have to have higher education to survive in Whatcom County. I mean, at this point, in order to get even the most basic of jobs, the requirements for having a living wage, until we can change that to a better place, then that make it more demanding, as well as even the people who are anti-globalization might want to have a very intelligent populace for our own security.
Well, look even at car repairs, a place where people who had limited formal education used to go. Today, you have to understand computers in order to do car repair. There isn't a place in the workforce for someone who isn't educated.
Or even a locksmith, right? For that matter. So we're just coming into our last couple of minutes. I wanted to bring up a couple of events. Actually, I want Jill to bring up one event. Yes.
For your listeners who might be interested in hearing more about positive solutions to jail, I would like to invite you to come and join the League of Women Voters on April 15th. Think about it as tax day. The League of Women Voters is going to be hosting a really special program out at the Heiner Auditorium at Whatcom Community College. It's open to the whole public. You don't have to be a League member, although you should join the League. It's open to the whole public. The topic is Jail Diversions, the World of the Possible. We're going to be looking at very positive solutions that are being used in other communities, specifically therapeutic courts and the broad use of therapeutic courts to try to keep people from being incarcerated and to use solutions to problems other than just putting people in jails. So it's from 9 until noon at the Heiner Auditorium on April 15th. And join us.
At Whatcom Community College. And I will be interviewing Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner, who is the executive director of Moms Rising. It's part of a Woman in Jeopardy event Saturday, April 8th. And that tickets are available at Eventbrite. And you'll hear more about that next week, as well as our other ongoing issues and brand new issues on Cascadia News. Now, I want to give a special thanks tonight to our guest host, Jill Bernstein, as well as Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. Cascadia News Now is produced by me, Stephanie Contouris. Our technical director is Dave Willingham. Huge cheers to our engineer, Devlin Sweeney. Woo! Thank you, Devlin. And you are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham, your community, your voice, your station.